Thanks for tuning into The Rundown here on KCPW. A little bit later in the program, we'll have a discussion with Sanjay Jali, the policy director for the Prometheus Radio Project, on the FCC-sanctioned growth of low-powered FM stations across the country. But first, this summary of today's top local news stories. And first up, the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office ruled this morning that the actions of two West Valley City drug detectives were not justified in a shooting that took place on November 2nd of last year. KCPW's Jordan Allred has more on the story.
After a nine-month investigation into a police shooting, Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill found West Valley Detectives Sean Cowley and Kevin Salmon were not justified in the use of deadly force which resulted in the killing of 21-year-old Danielle Willard. Gill says the district attorney's office is now looking into whether or not criminal charges will be filed against the detectives.
If charges are warranted, we will file them. If they're not warranted, then we won't file them. It is going to probably take a little bit of time. We have to gather that evidence, and we look to see what the quantity and quality of that evidence is, and to see if there's a reasonable likelihood of success at trial. So like we analyze any other criminal case, we will then start looking at it and putting it together for a screening of criminal charges.
Shortly after the shooting, and amid other controversial findings within the West Valley City Police, the department's Neighborhood Narcotics Unit was disbanded. This also led to the dismissal of 125 state and federal cases investigated by West Valley Police due to credibility issues. Gill addressed concerns community members may have regarding the West Valley City Police Department.
You know, it is unfortunate. We are, sifting through a whole bunch of issues. But the conduct of one or some officers should not taint what is the otherwise professional performance of many other officers. There are many policemen and women in West Valley City who do their job honorably, professionally, diligently, and conscientiously. I think West Valley has demonstrated that they want to address these issues. I think they're taking the steps and measures to address that. I'm confident that they're going to do what they need to do.
West Valley City Police Deputy Chief Mike Powell says that both Cowley and Salmon will remain on paid administrative leave as the investigation continues. For KCPW News, I'm Jordan Allred.
The 5th annual Craft Lake City Do-It-Yourself Festival starts Friday evening and goes through Saturday at the Gallivan Center. Angela Brown is the executive director of Craft Lake City and the editor and publisher of Slug Magazine. She says the festival bridges her love for crafts, such as canning food and cross-stitching that came from growing up LDS, with her love of underground alternative culture, including making zines and screen printing your own t-shirts. She says the festival will highlight many different interpretations of craft or art.
Anything from humanoid robots to sumo bots to vortex cannons, which those will be in our science and technology building with 3D printing. But then you can also find a woman who might hand stuff her own pillows and then screen print on top of them. Or you may find a harpist in the busking area.
There will also be food and two stages with different bands playing throughout the day. Brown says they added the science and technology section a couple of years ago to help shine the light on makers who are creating fun technology-based projects but aren't represented locally.
You know, we also wanted to take the emphasis off selling, that it's not just about coming and buying art. It's also about exhibiting your work. And in the science and technology building, you really see that, yeah, there's things for sale. You can buy a 3D printer for $4,000 if you'd like, but you can also just learn and engage and be inspired. And that's what the festival is about as well.
Brown says there will be over 200 artisans, 4 DIY engineers, 6 food trucks, and 5 on-site food vendors. She says they expect around 25,000 visitors during the festival, which is free to the public. The Tooele City Council is deciding whether to table an ordinance regulating the use of e-cigarettes. That ordinance sought to mirror the state's policies already in place concerning e-cigarettes. In Utah, it is illegal to smoke or, quote, vape e-cigarettes in public places. The devices are a fairly new invention, and little is known about the long-term health effects. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham takes a closer look at this quickly growing trend.
So basically, this case is like your starter kits and your batteries.
That's Stephen Northup. He's the co-owner, along with his brother, of Salt Lake Vapors, a store dedicated entirely to the sale of e-cigarettes. He started the store because he and his brother were looking for a way to quit smoking real cigarettes, the ones that burn and produce actual smoke.
My brother got into it about 3 years ago, and it helped him to not smoke cigarettes. So he just traded this for, you know, e-cigs, and he got me into it. And it just became more of a hobby to me, finding out all the new things that are out, you know, how everything works. We just decided to open up our shop and kind of help other people with that.
In fact, e-cigarettes are being marketed as an alternative to smoking tobacco. While e-cig companies can't legally tout their product as a healthier alternative, they do promote other benefits. Take this ad for Blue Electronic Cigarettes.
Blue lets me enjoy smoking without it affecting the people around me. Because it's vapor, not tobacco smoke. That means no ash. And best of all, no offensive odor. With Blue, you can smoke at a basketball game if you want to. And how about not having to go outside every 10 minutes when you're in a bar with your friends? The point is, you can smoke Blue virtually anywhere.
Anywhere except in public in Utah. In May of last year, Utah banned smoking e-cigarettes in public places such as most restaurants or parks. The ban was the result of classifying e-cigarettes in the same category as traditional tobacco products, such as regular cigarettes, cigars, and hookahs. However, while there's indisputable evidence that tobacco products are bad for your health, the jury is still out on e-cigarettes. In a statement, the Federal Food and Drug Administration says, quote, "Further research is needed to assess the potential public health benefits and risks of electronic cigarettes."
A lot of research is being done, and a lot of research has been concluded, but as far as long-term studies, there hasn't really been anything done.
That's Salt Lake Vapor's manager, Nathan Mitchell. He's yet to be convinced that e-cigarette vapor is harmful, but he understands the uneasiness some have around e-cig smokers.
There's definitely some etiquette that needs to come into play, and that's probably where a lot of this backlash is coming from, is people abusing the smoke anywhere mentality that a lot of these things are marketed with.
For his part, Northup thinks that the Utah law banning e-cigarettes in public isn't all that bad.
I agree with that law. You know, and I try to stay reasonable with that in my car, at my house. If I go park or shop or anything, I don't use it. Because it is vapor. A lot of people don't know what it is, so they can kind of be offended by it. You know, oh, they're smoking a cigarette. You know, that is harmful. So in that aspect, I do agree with that part of it.
It's still a new world for e-cigarette smokers. In the future, though, it's pretty clear that public perception of e-cigarettes hinges on its health impact. For KCPW, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
And that's our local news summary for the day. You're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. Stay with us. Now on the program, we turn to our discussion with Sanjay Jolly. Jolly is the policy director of the Prometheus Radio Project, which focuses on building a large community of low-power FM radio stations across the country in the wake of President Obama signing the Local Community Radio Act. He joined us by phone from his offices in Philadelphia. So what is you're the policy director of the Prometheus Radio Project. What is the Prometheus Radio Project?
The Prometheus Radio Project, we build, we support, and we advocate for community radio stations in the United States. We see community radio as a tool for building democracy. When communities participate in their own media, their own news and music and culture, that kind of participation we see as democracy in action. And our focus is to build a large community around low-power FM radio stations and their listeners, to build the foundation of a truly democratic participatory media.
When you say a low-power FM station, what does that consist of? What is the definition of a low-power FM station?
Well, so low-power FM stations, they're stations that are on the FM dial, but the antennas are much less powerful. So for low-power FM, the maximum power is 100 watts. And you can compare that to most commercial stations that are running around 10,000 or even 50,000 watts when they're running at full power. So 100 watts for a low-power station, that means that a station can transmit about 5 to 10 miles in any direction, which may not seem like a lot, but if we're talking about major cities, we're talking about a reach of hundreds of thousands of potential listeners.
So there was a law passed a couple of years ago called the Local Community Radio Act. Can you explain what it is and what's changing as a result of it?
The Local Community Radio Act is a law passed by Congress and signed by President Obama in 2011. And it mandates that the Federal Communications Commission, which is the federal regulator for radio, that they issue licenses, low-power FM radio licenses, to nonprofit organizations across the country. And also it lifted restrictions that previously kept these low-power FM stations outside of medium and large cities. And what this means for the media landscape is right now, if you tune into the FM dial, we're living at the result of really two decades of massive corporate media consolidation, where you have fewer and fewer owners controlling more and more media content. And low-power FM and the Local Community Radio Act is a pushback to that. And so for the media landscape, what it means is it puts some of the power of the media back into local control. So you'll see more diversity of radio ownership, a greater variety of formats, more locally relevant content. And right now, there are about 800 low-power stations on air in the United States. With this new application opportunity, that number could double or triple. To put that into context, Clear Channel, which is the largest radio station owner in the country, owns about 850 stations. So this is a real shift in what radio is going to look like in the United States.
And how did this happen? I mean, what was your organization's role in bringing about this? I don't know if you guys advocated for the Local Community Radio Act or who else was working on making this happen?
Yeah, well, so to give you some context, in the mid-1990s, there were two things happening at once. There was the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that was signed by President Clinton that, introduced massive deregulation of the telecom industry. It got rid of ownership restrictions, and it resulted in really heavy consolidation in radio and television. Now we have Clear Channel. Meanwhile, you had a grassroots movement of pirate radio stations across the country. Famously, there's Free Radio Brooklyn. And one of those stations, pirate radio stations, was a group called Radio Mutiny, operating out of West Philadelphia. And the FCC around this time was also really starting to crack down these pirate radio stations. And Radio Mutiny, after it got shut down by the FCC, became the Prometheus Radio Project in 1998. And so the Prometheus Radio Project, along with a really sort of broad coalition of pirate radio broadcasters, folks who took media into their own hands when they'd been shut out of the airwaves, they protested and they supported other pirate radio stations across the country, and the FCC heard them. And so what happened was Bill Kennard was running the FCC back then, and he saw these protests, he saw all these stations he was having to shut down, and he thought, there's a real problem here. All these folks are trying to get on the air. And so the FCC started, announced that they would issue these things called low-power FM licenses at 10 watts and 100 watts. So they did this, but the FCC had some pushback, specifically from the National Association of Broadcasters, which represents most commercial broadcasters in the United States. And in 2000, Congress passed and President Clinton signed the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act. And that placed the restrictions on low-power FM that, effectively kept them out of medium and large cities and relegated low-power FM to rural areas. So, for about a decade, the Prometheus Radio Project led a coalition to pass the Local Community Radio Act to really repeal the 2000 legislation and push the FCC to issue these new licenses.
And I would guess that there was at least some opposition. Who was against it and why?
Sure. In that fight, there were, the major radio broadcasters, really, really fought low-power FM. And so, they had concerns over interference, that low-power FM stations would interfere with existing commercial stations. The FCC commissioned a report. It's been widely debunked that low-power FM stations cause interference to existing full-power stations. But the larger broadcasters, represented by the National Association of Broadcasters and also National Public Radio, were really against it. I mean, from the standpoint of large, established commercial and even non-commercial broadcasters, you know, in any industry, who wants more competition?
You know, before the FCC began licensing LPFM stations in 2000, what were the options for small community radio stations? Radio was licensed beginning in 1927, I think. So what happened between 27 and 2000?
Well, I mean, there weren't a whole lot. I mean, the FCC was established in 1934. They started issuing really the equivalent of a low-power FM license in 1938. They were called Class D licenses. And they were, you know, sort of local, low-wattage licenses specifically for educational purposes. And so they were used a lot by schools especially. But then 1978, after this, you know, this new public media revolution that happened in the 70s, the FCC scrapped Class D licenses to make room for public radio. So from 1978 to 2000, you know, while public radio played a really important role in local communities, there were still a lot of sort of smaller shops, individuals, groups, artists, activists, you know, who couldn't get on the dial. And so they resorted to pirate radio. And so they operated without licenses for, you know, for over 20 years. And it was really in the 90s that the FCC really started cracking down on these pirate radio stations. And that, you know, and it's the activism of the leaders in the pirate radio movement and the free radio movement that led to the creation of low-power FM in 2000.
So the cracking down, to a certain extent, fostered that movement.
The cracking down, and also, you know, the response of the cracking down by, you know, by the folks who are in these stations. At one point, you know, the Radio Mutiny and the Community Radio Project, we, you know, led a protest at the National Association of Broadcasters and took down the National Association flag with a pirate flag, a Jolly Roger.
So can you speak to any of the groups who are applying for the LPFMs in October? Who are they, and you know, what's their sort of intent, or what is the use of LPFM stations generally?
There's no really typical LPFM applicant, you know, but the purpose of LPFM generally is to engage the local community where the station operates. Many of these low-power FM applicants are religious organizations, churches and temples and others. But many, you know, many others are schools and libraries, unions, arts and culture advocates, civil rights organizations. You know, I mean, I can give you some examples. I mean, one of the groups that we work with, one applicant group is an organization based in South Carolina that advocates for the African-American Gullah Geechee community. We work with another group that's a veterans organizing group. You know, one station in Seattle, their target audience are refugees who are in the Seattle-Tacoma area. And, you know, and they're trying to introduce radio in the languages of these resettled populations. So in the case of Seattle-Tacoma in Somalia. And, you know, lots of groups actually are trying to bring attention to local musicians and local artists. And then, you know, there are lots of municipal organizations like public safety and disaster relief groups.
Can you speak about the relevance or the need for LPFM stations in light of what is a very, you know, we've got satellite radio and podcasts and a highly digital and you know, online accessible world. How do these LPFM stations fit into that, you know, into that landscape?
Yeah, I mean, there are folks, especially younger people, that I think have the perception that radio is a dated medium. But in most people's everyday lives, you know, in the car, in the kitchen, running errands, whatever, you know, radio is still the best way to reach people. 93% of Americans listen to radio regularly. It's 70% for broadband internet, just about 50% for online radio, and 25% for podcasts. So, you know, maybe in 10 or 20 years, the point that radio is dated and, you know, the internet is how folks are, is the best way to reach people. Maybe that'll be a relevant point in, you know, 5, 10, 20 years. But, you know, but right now, radio is still, radio and television are still the dominant mediums in people's lives.
So for those who are interested, is there still time to apply to get one of these low-power FM stations?
Yeah, the application window is October 15th through 29th. It's a 2-week window. But there is a lot of work that needs to go in that, you know, that goes into this application. At this point, the sooner organizations can start their application, the better. We have Prometheus, we have a website, we have webinars on how to get through the application. We have forums linking different folks involved in Low Power FM together, including lawyers, broadcast lawyers and broadcast engineers. And we have a channel finder to see if there's an available frequency in your area.
Who is able to apply? You know, like, basically, is it individuals or are we talking about organizations?
No, so individuals cannot apply. The FCC states that only non-commercial educational entities are eligible to apply. So any nonprofit organization, schools, public safety agencies, municipal transportation organizations, and organizations can only own one station. They can only run one station.
So I just want to finally ask you if you know if any channels are available in Utah.
Yeah, I mean, there are stations available in Utah, stations available, there are channels available in Salt Lake City, a few of them. And we were specifically working with like 5 or 6 organizations in Utah. And there's a lot of, I mean, especially now in large and medium cities where LPFM, wasn't previously allowed to operate. There's a lot of enthusiasm behind this. The other interesting thing is that there have always, churches, just given that they're well-organized, given their missions and given that they're relatively well-financed compared to other nonprofits, have always, since the very beginning of LPFM, have really sort of gotten behind Low Power FM, and you'll see, especially in rural areas, a lot of church radio stations, low power radio stations. But one of the interesting things that we're seeing this, for this window in this application, which I mean quite likely is the last time you'll ever be able to get radio spectrum in major cities, is that Hispanic groups, not just church groups, but different sorts of, Latino Spanish speaking groups, are applying in huge numbers, definitely way more than we saw in 2000. And a lot of that is because community radio is in Mexico and Guatemala and the other sort of countries in Central America, community radio is a much more common medium and a really well-understood medium.
Sanjay Jolly, Policy Director at the Prometheus Radio Project, I want to thank you for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Sanjay Jolly, the policy director for the Prometheus Radio Project. You can hear this interview and all of the conversations we feature on this program at our website, kcpw.org. And that's our show for the day. The Rundown was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for a discussion with Salt Lake Tribune film critic Sean P. Means on 20 years of reviewing movies and on writing about Utah's oft-panned liquor laws. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.